You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. There's a good chance you're counting on WPR now more than ever, so we've reduced this spring member drive to prioritize the content you need in this unprecedented time. A listener from Madison said, "Thank you for all that you do to educate, enlighten, and brighten the Wisconsin community. Your support of the programs you value is so important, and today's your last chance to give during Central Time. Give now at 888-202-2552. That's 888-202-2552, or online at WPR.org, and thank you." Now, Wisconsin is known for its agriculture, but perhaps not as much for the products grown inside. In a state where dairy farmers are closing down, could fish farming be another option? 90% of seafood eaten in the U.S. is imported from other countries. According to a survey conducted by the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute, 84% of Wisconsinites say they eat fish at least once a month. There wasn't data on how much of that happens on Fridays. There's been growth in Wisconsin in the use of aquaponics, where fish and veggies provide nutrients to one another. Chris Hartleb is a professor of fisheries biology and the director of the Northern Aquaculture Demonstration Facility at UW-Stevens Point. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, I've only seen a little bit about this over the years, but it's apparently a big deal and getting bigger. Aquaponics. Tell us what this is and how it works.
Sure. Aquaponics is a hybrid of aquaculture as well as hydroponics. So you take from aquaculture the farming of fish, and you combine it with hydroponics, which is raising crops in a soilless environment, basically in water. And you combine the two, and you feed your fish. Your fish grow. They also produce waste. That waste is then converted into nutrients, and those nutrients head right to the plants. And then the plants are floating in water, and that water then is returned cleaner back to the fish again.
And so if I'm in this business, I would ultimately be selling fish and maybe also selling some kind of veggies, lettuce and things like that?
Sure. I mean, basically, you'd be farming a meal, something with fish and then your vegetables on the side.
So you got a salmon Caesar salad, pretty much, apart
sure.
from the dressing, I guess. Now, what? Paint a picture for us of what this looks like if we walked into an aquaponics facility.
Well, that's interesting because there's probably one right nearby you. And that is, they range everything from some backyard hobbyists all the way up to large commercial production. In Wisconsin, because of our winters, they have to be done indoors, most of the time in a greenhouse. They have rows and rows of plants that they're growing and for the vegetables. And then they would have a series of tanks set up with a variety of different types of fish, depending on what their interest is.
And how big a business is this getting to be in Wisconsin? You mentioned they're, you know, all over the place, at least in small forms. Are we starting to see Wisconsin, you know, see this take off in Wisconsin?
Well, I would say definitely. I mean, it's like any industry. It's suffering growing pains. But in general, the trend is more and more farms are succeeding. And like I said, it goes everything from a do-it-yourselfer or a backyard hobbyist all the way to a local farm that may be serving just your town's market. And then we've got some large ones coming online that are actually serving the entire upper Midwest.
I know some people have raised concerns over the years with outdoor fish farming, concerns over environmental impact. When it comes to aquaponics, how do you gauge the environmental impact and how it stacks up to other ways of getting us fish?
Right. Actually, it has the smallest footprint because it's basically what we refer to as a closed system. The water goes from the fish to some filters to the plants and then back to the fish again. So the water basically just recirculates in the system. Most farms will be basically replacing maybe about 10% of the water that they use each day, which can be easily filtered by, you know, putting the nutrient-rich water onto fields around it, or they can capture those waste products so they don't enter out into the environment.
Talking to Chris Hartleb, professor of fisheries biology and director of the Northern Aquaculture Demonstration Facility at UW-Stevens Point. We're talking about aquaponics, a combination of fish farming and hydroponic vegetable raising all in one facility. You participate in workshops, Chris, that serve as kind of a boot camp, I understand, for people who want to get into this. What do people need to know before they start to give this a try?
Well, for the most part, we'll just start off by saying that they need to realize that it's farming. Most often when people contact me, it's because they're running into problems. And if they start off their sentences with, "Well, I went away for the weekend," and I tell them to stop right there because
oh, no.
Farming is 24/7. So that's what most of the people that have come to our boot camps or our workshops generally come from some other type of business background. So they come to learn about the science of aquaponics, and that is farming fish and then farming those crops.
And we know there's a concern in Wisconsin. A lot of dairy farms have gone out of operation over the last few years. A lot of people still in might be looking for a replacement or some kind of diversification. Are you seeing interest on Wisconsin dairy farms to see if this might be something they can add to their mix?
I've gotten a couple of calls from dairy farmers wondering, you know, what aquaponics is because they've heard about it or seen it in the news. And I think it's an interesting prospect for them. As I mentioned, most of the contacts I have that those people attending our classes or our boot camps come from some type of almost like a white collar job where they know business and finance and they need to be taught how to farm, what the science of the farming is. The dairy farmers would come from the other direction. They know how to farm and they probably have a lot of the infrastructure already. So it would be more of, you know, aiding or assisting them on, okay, so they can grow the fish, they can grow the vegetables. Now, how do you market those in a market that's used to traditional agriculture?
And Chris, I should ask for people who eat the fish, I may have buried the lead here. What kind of fish are we raising here in Wisconsin's aquaponics community?
Sure. I mean, the most common one is tilapia.
I think we lost Chris Hartlib there. I'm not sure if we'll be able to get him back quickly. Chris, are you there?
Yeah. Hello?
Well, I'm not hearing him come back to me. Chris, what kind of fish do we raise here in Wisconsin aquaponics?
Sure. The most common one is tilapia because it's a relatively easy fish to raise. And it also feeds low on the food chain. So the food that you feed the fish tends to be less expensive. But most of our customers in Wisconsin would rather eat native fish from here. So they like to see something like an Atlantic salmon or a walleye or a yellow perch or bluegill or something like that. So really, you know, the sky's the limit on what you can raise. But, you know, more farmers, I think, are realizing that they need to tailor their fish crops to what the consumer wants to eat.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's a lot of new research coming out on the coronavirus. How can we make sense of it all? We'll ask an infectious disease doctor from the Mayo Clinic. First, for our own safety, most of us are staying away from family, friends, and coworkers. That distance is contributing to the comeback of the phone call, not video calls or messaging or social media, just two people, one line, talking. Our guest covers technology and talks to people who are using the phone in ways they hadn't in years or ever. Incidentally, I am hosting remotely today, and we had a connection problem, so I'm using the phone in a way that I haven't in years. I'm using it on the air. Cecilia Kang is a technology reporter for the New York Times. Her recent piece is titled, "The Humble Phone Call Has Made a Comeback." Cecilia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Cecilia, you looked into the numbers here. What does the data show when it comes to how much we're talking on the phone?
Yeah, the data shows a real surge in plain old phone calls. And I spoke to the two biggest carriers of phone calls, the two biggest phone companies, Verizon and AT&T, and they themselves are quite shocked by how much calling we're doing. And I'm just talking plain old calling. I'm not talking about FaceTime or Skype or what have you on video calling. This is just using your wireless phone or your landline phone at home. Verizon says that it has seen about 800 million wireless calls every day, and that's double the number that's typically their peak day figure. The peak day is typically Mother's Day, and that's historically been the busiest day for calling in the year. And Verizon said that every day now they're taking about double, they're handling about double the amount of their peak calls. AT&T also said that they're seeing cellular phone calls rise about 35%, and Wi-Fi-based calls are about double double from averages in normal times. So it's pretty phenomenal. They were surprised themselves by the big peak in traffic of phone calls.
Now, you talked to a few people, Cecilia, for your story on the phone call. Tell us about Alyssa. How did she find herself using her phone recently or differently in recent weeks?
So Alyssa McKenzie, she's 32 years old. She lives in New Canaan, Connecticut, which is pretty close to New York City, about less than an hour away. She is very much a millennial in that she almost never used the phone part of her smartphone. She used the texting portion. She used the apps. But the crisis and being quarantined at home has led her to use the phone much more. She's been calling, for example, her family members who just live down the road, less than 2 miles away, multiple times a day. Her mom, just the other day, she called up and just needed a recipe for a pasta fagioli soup. And she said, you know, I've got some beans, I've got some tomato paste, I don't know what to do. They're talking about the recipes, and they started talking about her younger brother. Then they started talking about their days. They made some observations about what they're watching on TV these days. Next thing they knew, the soup was done. The 2 hours later, 2 hours had passed, and they were still talking. This is somebody who had almost never called her mom on the phone before this.
That's, yeah, and I think a lot of people are in that boat now, Cecilia. You also talked to folks at a church, I think it was in Louisiana, and how they've kind of harnessed the system of the phone to keep in touch with the rest of their congregation.
Yeah, it's sort of a back to, you know, back to the past, a throwback situation there where two priests and the deacons there, nine members total at the Church of St. Margaret, Queen of Scotland Church in Albany, Louisiana. They divided their list of 900 parishioners, and they just did the plain, something that's been done maybe in the far past. I think I remember doing this when I was young, which is just doing like phone marathon, kind of phone trees, calling and just checking in on congregants. And so of those nine people, they had each person had 100 people to call in that week. They're going to circulate their list of 100 among those nine members every week. And it was, you know, really touching, actually, to hear some of the stories from the associate priest I spoke to. His name is Brad Doyle. And he said that, you know, at first he would call, and some of the congregants were really taken aback because a lot of us are not used to getting legitimate phone calls anymore. Immediately people thought that he might be a robocall. And so there's a lot of questions of, like, who is this? How do you know who I am? What's my number? And say, well, I'm past. I'm Father Brad Doyle at the church. And then they immediately loosen up. And what he found was is that a lot of people were lonely. They were feeling quite isolated. They were very grateful to have a listening ear. So that's just one great example of how a community around that church, it's in a rural area of Louisiana, has in some ways come together through the phone. And they're going to keep doing this until the lockdown orders are lifted in Louisiana.
Now, this is amazing. Going back to that big picture data you mentioned, you know, double the usual volume on a Mother's Day. Did this catch telecommunications companies by surprise, ones that had been, you know, trying to ramp up their internet stuff all these years?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. When the first stay-at-home orders took place, Washington State, then I think California, New York, then you saw the rollout across the country, these orders by state, the telecommunications companies, they braced for a surge in internet traffic, and they're really worried about whether their internet networks could handle it, those the broadband last mile into your home. And so they were adding capacity, they had all hands on deck, and definitely internet traffic has increased. There's a lot more internet uses. People learn and work from home. But what they didn't expect is people just getting on the phone to talk, just a plain old talk. And this is for business, this is for social, this is for so many other so many purposes. So they were taken aback. I mean, the good thing is that the phone network is probably one of the most reliable and one of the farthest reaching of all communication services. Still, a lot of homes do not have internet service, about 25 million, but just about every home has, except for a very nominal percentage, has a phone connection, either by cellular or landline, available to them. So this system that's been in place for more than 130 years has been a real lifeline for folks at home and also a real source of comfort. And so the phone companies are, one of the AT&T executives I spoke to, he's an executive vice president, he was saying, voice is the new killer app, which I thought was kind of funny.
We're talking to Cecilia Kang, technology reporter for the New York Times. Her recent piece is titled The Humble Phone Call Has Made a Comeback. A lot of people want to talk to each other in this time where they can't actually see each other in person, and phone calls are coming back in a really big way. Cecilia, I mean, there's a generation that's grown up looking at the phone as something you do pretty much everything but talk on. Cell phones started as a talking thing, but now there's the apps and texting and everything but talking is the way you use your phone. Are we seeing a new that generation now maybe embrace talking again on the phone?
Maybe. Let's see if this actually sticks. But I was really struck by one person who I spoke to, a student, a junior at the State University of New York at Binghamton. Her name is Emily Lancia. She's 20 years old, and she's a junior, as I said. And she had never talked to her friends, her peers, on the phone at all. And she was walking around the campus nature preserve one day. It was just beautiful out. And she was just walking in. And I can see this. I can see why she did this. There's a lot of logic to this. She's walking and she thought, okay, instead of texting and instead of FaceTiming, I'm just going to call up my best friend from high school who I've never, ever talked to on the phone. I text her every day, but I've never have. And she called her up in her contacts. Her friend was a little bit surprised. They had a pleasant 20-minute conversation while she was walking. And it made a lot, she said, yeah, I just realized the phone is so easy. I don't have to do much. And she said, it was also really nice just to hear my friend's voice. So Emily is a good example of somebody who's discovering the phone for the first time in a way. She, the only other people she talks to are her parents, who she used to talk to on the phone about once a week. And she's now talking to them multiple times a day. So if Emily is sort of if she pretends, something, maybe a comeback to the phone of that generation, then it's pretty promising.
And I don't remember if it was her or someone else you talked to made kind of walking dates with people where, wherever they were, they each went for their own walk, but on the phone together at the same time. And I know my wife and her mom have done some of that when the days have been nice enough here. So kind of appointment conversations and going for walks together, even though you're not together.
Yes, and I've been so surprised. So that was another person who I spoke to. Her name is Grace McClellan. She lives in Charleston, South Carolina, and her best friend is currently staying in Connecticut. And she lives alone, Grace, or at least she's single and she doesn't have family with her, that she's staying in quarantine. And so for her, what's really helped her with the feeling of isolation is making these appointment walk and talks. And when she said this, I sort of just had this kind of oh my God, me too. Because I've been doing this as well. I don't know if you mentioned your wife. I don't know if you've been doing that as well. I'm sure some of your listeners have as well. I found it really nice. I think many of us are taking walks these days, very long walks when we can safely. And I do this all the time. I talk to my parents just about every day, walking, my siblings, my friends. I never did that before. And Grace was one of many people who I talked to who did this. And I had so many other people reach out after the story was published and saying that this is one of the best things that they've discovered is just being able to feel like they're walking with a friend just by having them sort of their voices pipe through their earbuds while they're walking. And I thought that was kind of a nice image because it is about as close as we'll get to being closest that we will get to being actually physically close to somebody without really being close to somebody physically in a way that violates our quarantine rules.
And Cecilia, it struck me reading your piece on this. Your title is Technology Reporter, and this is technology, but at root, it's such a human story about connection and our psychology and our need for contact with each other. I'm just kind of thinking out loud there. What do you think about that?
Yeah. Well, I really liked the story. I love writing this story because it is so human. I think also at this time, the story resonated with folks because not only did they see themselves in some of the people who I interviewed, but we were all hungry for some silver lining stories and some of these stories that make us feel like we're closer together than alone and further apart. And I thought this was a nice example of where technology, telecommunications can bring us close together, even in this really extraordinary time.
Cecilia, thank you so much for sharing this with us today. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Cecilia Kang is a New York Times technology reporter. We talked to her about her recent piece on the comeback of the phone call. Well, I'm really lucky because I have, appointment conversations with you and great guests and people all over the state and all over the world each and every day. And I feel really fortunate to be able to have this connection with you all. If you appreciate having this this time to connect with people, your neighbors, your friends, and everybody else listening around Wisconsin, I want you to know that we count on you to help support it. It's our spring member drive. We're not making a lot of noise about it, but we from time to time ask you to help pay for what we do here. Now is a chance to do that. It's the last weekday of the drive, last chance to make that support during Central Time. You can make your gift right now at 888-202-2552. Again, 888-202-2552. Or you can go online at WPR.org to make that gift. Thank you so much if you're able to support now, if you've given in the past, if you're a current member and you're making ongoing donations as a sustainer. We couldn't do what we do without you. Thank you so very much. Coming up, an infectious disease specialist from Mayo Clinic joins the show to help us understand the latest and the changing research on the novel coronavirus. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. WPR is your go-to for great conversations, important news and analysis, and some fun along the way, too. It's probably true now more than ever. It's the last weekday of our spring member drive, and we've reduced our on-air fundraising to prioritize content you rely on at this unique time. That's why your gift right now is so important. Listeners are the biggest source of funding for all the programs you care about, which means that all the programs you value, like Central Time, are here thanks to you. Give now at 888-202-2552. That's 888-202-2552 or online at WPR.org. And thank you. Coming up Monday at 6 on the morning show, the COVID-19 pandemic is changing the way we remember lost loved ones. Two funeral directors join the show to talk about the ways they're helping families stay safe during funerals and memorial services. It's Monday morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, if you've turned on the news lately, chances are you've probably heard something about new research findings on the coronavirus. Things like how far it can travel, how long it can stay suspended in air can be a lot to keep up with, and there isn't always a consensus among researchers about what it means and what to do with that info. So how can we start to make sense of it all, and what are some strategies to help you understand what's right, what's wrong, and what's in the gray area? Dr. Nipuni Rajapakse is a pediatric infectious disease doctor at Mayo Clinic. Dr. Rajapakse, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, before we get into particular studies and bits of information, just for us lay people out there, how do you recommend we read, you know, that new news headline about latest research on transmission or efforts to find a cure or anything related to this disease?
So I think there's really been a flood of information that has come out about COVID-19. I think it's really important that we all understand how to tell the good and accurate information apart from some of the misinformation that has come out as well. It's really been heartwarming to see kind of the response of the scientific community in terms of studying this disease that really 3.5 months ago we didn't know anything about, and the amount of new information that has come out since then has been really heartwarming to see. I think it's really important that people are getting their news and information from validated sources that are critically evaluating some of the studies that have come out, and ensuring that these studies are done using proper scientific methods so that we're basing all of our actions and decisions on sound scientific information.
Well, I want to take a look at one example. There was a researcher at MIT who said droplets carrying coronavirus could travel as far as 27 feet. Here's a response from Dr. Anthony Fauci, part of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, to a reporter's question about that study.
This could really be terribly misleading, John. What it was looking at the distance that droplets fly by speaking, by coughing, by sneezing. So if you go way back and go, achoo, and go like that, you might get 27 feet. But so when you see somebody do that, get out of the way.
There are some people
but that's not practical.
I know people that can do
that. That is not practical, John. I'm sorry, but I was disturbed by that report because that's misleading. That means that all of a sudden the 6-foot thing doesn't work. That is a very, very robust, vigorous achoo sneeze. That's what that is. And that's not what we're talking about.
And Dr. Rajapakse, that's where it can be tricky. It's not that study itself was wrong. They had measured a thing. It's kind of what we do with it and how we interpret it on a practical level. How do we sort that out as we in the media and you in the science world try to communicate that without misleading people?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the case with things like this. So it's important to realize that there are certain situations or conditions that you can set up in a lab setting that really would not be mimicked in real life. So this also applies to some of the studies that have come out looking at how long the virus survives on certain types of surfaces, for example. And so some of these studies have had widely differing estimates ranging from a few hours to a few days. And really those studies are really dependent on the exact situations that they have set up in the lab in order to test this. So we know that things like exposure to UV light or humidity or how much virus is on the surface to begin with really affects how long it will last. And so it's really important that while these studies are very helpful in helping us kind of understand the virus better, that we take the conclusions and we apply them in a way that makes sense to real life situations and scenarios.
Well, let's talk about the distancing and how far a virus could successfully be transmitted in air. Based on what we know and then the latest research, what should people be thinking about?
So I think when it comes to transmission, there's a lot of different factors that we have to weigh in. Some of the information that we're using to understand transmission of this virus has to come from our knowledge of transmission of other similar viruses, just because this one has not been around long enough for us to be able to fully study it itself. And so based on the information we have about other similar viruses, so other viruses in the coronavirus family, including prior viruses like SARS or Middle East Respiratory Syndrome coronavirus that have caused quite severe outbreaks, we still believe that the primary mode of spread of this virus is via respiratory droplets. And we see that spread is happening most commonly amongst people who are in close contact. So that is within that 6-foot distance from someone who is infected. And so while there may be certain situations, including certain types of scenarios that may happen within a hospital setting, if someone's having certain procedures done, that would result in the virus being spread in different ways, such as through aerosols, which is another word people may be hearing a lot. Mm-hmm. The primary mode of spread is still thought to be droplets. I think one of the tricky things about this virus that it took a bit of time for us to appreciate was the fact that people who don't have symptoms or don't have symptoms yet can still transmit it. This is quite different than the other coronaviruses that we have more experience with. For example, SARS back in 2002, people really didn't spread that virus or transmit it until they were well into their period of developing symptoms. And so for that outbreak, it was very effective to just find all the people who had symptoms and isolate them. And that was really one of the main reasons why that outbreak was controlled so quickly. So it's a different case for this virus, and we're all kind of having to learn on the go about it. And that's kind of one of the unique things that has come up that has also resulted in some of the recommendations changing around the use of masks and other protective equipment.
And yeah, what are the most recent thoughts as you're seeing on the use of masks? I know the CDC had recommended that we non-healthcare people, for example, wear cloth masks out in public. What are we accomplishing when we do that?
Yeah, so that's a great question. When someone who does not have symptoms is wearing a mask, you are really doing that to prevent transmission to other people in the chance that you have infection, but you're not showing any symptoms of it. So wearing the cloth mask in public is really to protect people around you rather than to protect yourself. They've looked at some studies looking at the cloth masks to see how well they filter the air that you're breathing in. And unfortunately, they don't perform very well for that function. But what they do well is to keep any droplets that are produced when you speak or cough or sneeze. They keep those from extending out very far beyond you and therefore can protect the people around you. So that's why recommendation is there.
We're talking to Dr. Nipuni Rajapakse, a pediatric infectious disease doctor at Mayo Clinic. She's with us to talk about some of the latest coronavirus research coming out and how we can make sense of it all, even if we're not scientists ourselves. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What studies have you seen coming out in the news? Do you feel confused comparing one headline, one study to another? How do you decide what's worth paying attention to and which ones may not be? Do you have a question for our guest about kind of the state of the art when it comes to how this disease spreads, how the treatment, the quest for treatment is going? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about coronavirus research literacy and how to make sense of the changing research we're seeing in the news. Dr. Nipuni Rajapakse is with us. She's a pediatric infectious disease doctor at Mayo Clinic. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about when it comes to how we in the public should deal with this illness based on the latest research? What are some of your trusted sources you go to for information? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Rajapakse, let's talk about research now on treatments. Now, there are a couple drugs out there in the news that have been used to treat things like malaria and lupus and rheumatoid conditions. It's got a little politicized, but there's, you know, hope that they can be useful treatments, mixed results from studies, I know. What do we know about the latest research trying to see if existing drugs could help us here?
Yeah, so that's a really great question, and a question that many of us healthcare providers have as well and are looking into. There are many what we would call candidate therapeutics. So there's nothing that has been proven to be helpful for treatment of COVID-19 yet, but there are many different medications that we think may be helpful. And because we don't have that proof yet, these are generally being studied in what we would call a clinical trial. So clinical trial involves enrolling patients who have the disease, in this case COVID-19, with their consent, and then testing some of the medications to see, one, whether they work, and two, what any of the downsides or side effects might be. And this is done in a very standardized and systematic way, usually in comparison to a group of patients who get a placebo or a medication that is not active, so that we can surely know whether the medication itself has had an effect or not. And so hundreds of these are in progress around the world, looking at some of the different medications that people have probably been hearing about, things like hydroxychloroquine or remdesivir or other antiviral medications, as well as some medications that work on the immune system and how it interacts with this virus, as well as something called convalescent plasma, which is taking antibody from people who have recovered from the illness and giving that to people who are sick to see if that helps them to fight it off even faster.
That's right. We talked to a Wisconsin doctor who had COVID-19 is now donating his own plasma for research. I want to bring our callers in now at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Rusk County. Mike, hello.
Hi. I'm hoping that the guests can help reinforce or clarify some. A lot of the people on social media and in other alternative media are pushing the whole idea of the mortality rate, and that while it's only 98.5% of the people, or 1.5% or less, that are dying, therefore it's really pretty good risk or pretty good odds. But I would hope that the guest would clarify that it's not really the mortality. The mortality rate is driven by access to healthcare and the ability to get modern medicine and so forth, and that the mortality rate would jump up substantially if our hospitals get overwhelmed and so forth. Could you speak to that and help people understand to get stuck on this mortality rate?
Mike, thanks for the call, Dr. Rajapakse. So the impact of the mortality rate, but also how many people are ending up in the hospital because of this, those are two separate but related reasons for why we worry about this thing.
Yeah, so that's a really great question, and I agree. There's been kind of a lot of misinformation or misperception of the information that is out there. I think you make a great point that the mortality rate from this is not really just one number. We know that there are certain groups that are at higher risk of dying, and so we know older adults and people who have underlying health problems, the mortality rate for them is certainly much higher than it is for younger people. And so, and we also know that your mortality rate is also related, as was mentioned, to your access to healthcare. So in a situation where we do an excellent job of flattening the curve, which we are seeing in some areas of the Midwest now, our hospitals are then able to cope with the number of patients who become ill and have the resources to use a ventilator if a patient needs one or use other life-sustaining treatments. And in that scenario, we can hopefully keep the mortality rate relatively low. But if we get into a situation where we have a large surge in cases, that's a situation where you see the mortality rate increase because our healthcare system just doesn't have the resources to provide all of the life-saving equipment or personnel that many, many sick people would need all at once. And so in that situation, here or in parts of the world where they just don't have access to ICU-level care, we will see that the mortality rate is higher than what is being quoted. I think the numbers that are also being quoted currently are based on partial information just related to how much testing we've been able to do as well. And so I do expect to see those numbers change as we go through this pandemic as well.
We just have a few moments left. I want to pass on a question from a caller, Lisa, who says she's a healthcare worker and she wonders what precautions she should take to not to protect her young daughter and others, given that she might be exposed at a healthcare facility. In our last minute, can you talk about that, Dr. Rajapakse?
Yeah, so this is certainly a question that I empathize with as well. I think everyone in healthcare is being very brave and showing up to work to take care of these patients that really need us while also being concerned about our taking this home to our own families at home. So I think from a healthcare provider perspective, adhering to all of the recommendations that your hospital has in terms of wearing the appropriate personal protective equipment, eye protection, masks, gowns, gloves, if you're interacting with patients who have or are suspected to have COVID-19. And then we've been recommending if people are wearing scrubs, you can change into different clothing at work instead of taking them home and making sure that anything you're wearing at work goes into the laundry straight away. I cannot overemphasize the importance of hand washing as well. Hand washing as soon as you leave your work area, as soon as you get home, will really help protect your loved ones at home as well.
Dr. Rajapakse, thank you so much for joining us, and I hope we can talk to you again in the not-too-distant future.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Dr. Nipuni Rajapakse, pediatric infectious disease doctor at Mayo Clinic. She was with us today to break down what we need to know about some of the new and changing research on the novel coronavirus and tips for how we can make sense of that research on the coronavirus in the future. A recent study found that a third of tenants didn't pay their rent at the beginning of this month. And with unemployment claims at a record high in Wisconsin, a lot of people are wondering how they're going to pay the bills during the coronavirus pandemic. WPR's Maureen McCollum talked with experts about how to pay for rent, what to do about apartment showings, and what happens if you're being removed from your home.
We've received a lot of questions from listeners about housing through WPR's Wisconsin Project. Renters and landlords have both written in with questions about evictions. Currently in Wisconsin, there is an eviction moratorium in effect until May 26th. So what happens after that?
On May 27th, hopefully lessors and lessees will have worked out things in order to have a smooth transition into what I hope is a much more normal world.
That's Mitch, which is his full name, a University of Wisconsin Law School clinical professor and director of the Neighborhood Law Clinic.
But I'm worried, like a lot of folks that do rental housing law, that on May 27th, we may see a lot of lessors start to commence evictions against lessees.
Evictions are a multi-step process in Wisconsin, so it's unlikely that people would be kicked out of their homes on May 27th. But many experts, including Mitch, say Wisconsin could see widespread evictions stretched out over time, especially if people are unable to afford their rent right now.
But as a lawyer, I would highly recommend people talk it through and not filing lawsuits. Apply for aid, talk to one another, and then calmly communicate. We can work through this together, and I think it will be a much smoother, much more respectful process for everyone involved.
So what happens if people can't afford the rent?
A tenancy agreement or a rental agreement is a legal contract, and so you do still have the obligation to pay your rent.
That's Kurt Paulson. He's an associate professor in UW-Madison's Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture. He told WPR's Central Time that there's a lot of confusion surrounding this right now. A moratorium on evictions does not mean tenants don't have to pay rent. Landlords still have to pay the mortgage, plus property taxes, maintenance, and utility bills. Paulson's best advice? He says renters should talk with landlords ASAP to work out an arrangement.
If you are renting and if you are still in a house, if you can, you still need to pay your rent and you need to talk to your landlord. A lot of landlords are working out deals with their tenants to pay a portion of the rent or to delay a payment for a while. But even if you are able to delay a payment, you'll still be obligated to pay that back at some point in time in the future.
Unemployment benefits and federal relief payments rolling out this week can help cover housing costs. Landlords can request mortgage forbearance. There are also community organizations that can provide rental assistance, although many of those places are stretched thin right now. We've heard from a number of landlords and renters about another question. What if I need to show an apartment? People are still allowed to move into a new home at this point in time. But Wisconsin's Safer at Home order prohibits landlords from entering a rental unit unless emergency maintenance is required. That means in-person apartment showings are off the table if the space is occupied. Again, Mitch encourages property owners and renters to work together. Renters can help by taking photos or videos in their homes.
You know, not a lot of folks are going to want to come out and tour apartments during this crisis, as we're all supposed to social distance. You know, like we're all doing virtual meetings and remote instruction. There should be remote and virtual apartment showings.
People with more specific questions about housing and rentals are encouraged to contact an attorney or tenants' rights groups. Maureen McCollum, Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you have more questions about housing during the pandemic, you can go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. There you can find more information for renters and homeowners, including resources to help pay rent, mortgages, and utilities. You can also ask your own questions while you're there about COVID-19. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, home care workers, grocery store employees, and many others are still at work during the COVID-19 outbreak. A guest makes the case that they deserve hazard pay for showing up. People are relying more than ever on the internet for entertainment, companionship, and work. So how is the infrastructure holding up? A technology writer joins the show for a look at how companies are keeping up with increased demand. And you could tell us how things are going for you with your work and other online connection needs. Plus, we'll look at some of the latest news of the day. And this is going to be fun. We'll check out a biography of Wisconsin's own Harry Houdini and his Appleton roots. That's coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Monday at 8, Kate's guest says we can look at the current pandemic as a dress rehearsal for the coming impacts of climate change. Find out why Monday at 8 on the morning show. You turn to the Ideas Network every day knowing you can find info, connection, and companionship when you need them. This spring member drive, we've pared down our messaging to preserve the programs you count on, programs that are powered by listeners like you. Today is the last weekday of the drive, and that means it's the last time to give during Central Time. Hey, here's a little extra thing. We brought back a longtime favorite, the WPR socks. We hope this thank you gift can be a source of comfort and delight, a reminder of the connection we share and your support for the programs you enjoy. Get those socks, a pair of them, not just one, two. When you give $10 a month or more at 888-202-2552 or WPR.org. Up next, Food Friday, Dory Greenspan, and baking. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.
Our world gets more complex all the time. You rely on WPR to turn complicated issues and the news of the day into understandable language. This essential service that you count on relies on your support. It's the largest source of our funding. If you've never given before, make a contribution now of, say, $10 a month at 888-202-2552 or WPR.org.
PBS Wisconsin is proud to offer Bright by Text, a free texting service for parents and caregivers of children ages 8 and younger. Text the word BADGER to 274-448 and receive research-based, age-specific resources and activities from trusted content partners like PBS Kids. Get free educational resources delivered to your phone with Bright by Text from PBS Wisconsin. Just text BADGER to 274-448.
Live from NPR News, I'm Jack Spear. Republican lawmakers now say they are willing to accept a demand from Democrats that any additional funding for loans to small businesses also include some